part of what it means to be human is to be aware of our mortality, to wrestle with this existential situation in which we unwittingly find ourselves, of being alive and having to die. Because ultimately, as the saying goes, none of us are getting out of this alive. Realizing our finitude can be terrifying. It can also be motivating. As our UU forebear, Henry David Thoreau, said in Walden, "I wished to live deliberately, and not, when I came to die, discovered that I had never really lived. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life." The temptation can be to repress this awareness of our mortality. But there can be tragic consequences. Some of you can think of examples from your own life, from your own friends and family, of consequences when we perpetually put off these conversations about what we want at the end of life, if at all possible. The surgeon Atul Gawande tells the story of a patient who demanded, "Don't you give up on me, give me every chance I've got." The will to live is often undeniably strong, but with the advances that we have today in medicine, the desire to live at all costs can have serious unintended consequences. Gawande writes, I believe then that this patient had chosen badly. I believe this still. He chose badly not because of the dangers, but because the operation didn't give him a chance of achieving what he really wanted. What he really wanted was his continence, his strength. He wanted back the life he had previously known, but he was pursuing little more than a fantasy at the risk of a prolonged and terrible death. And that is precisely what he got. Those are hard words, but they call us to be more honest about life and more honest about death with ourselves and with our loved ones. How many of you have read Gawande's best-selling book, Being Mortal? Okay, a few of you. I recommend it. The runaway success of this book is one among many hopeful signs that our culture is slowly becoming more willing to confront in a more mature way the realities of death and dying. Gawande's book is short but profound, Being Mortal. Now, I'll leave to another day the philosophical discussion of whether we would want to live forever if that were an option. As Woody Allen said, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying." He said, "I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment." But since living forever on this earth is not yet an option, I'd like to invite us to reflect on what is possible. What are the ways of increasing our likelihood of dying well? That's actually not a term you hear people talk about often enough. What does it mean to die well? Or what some people call, what would a good enough death look like? Here's one example of what a good enough death might mean. It might mean being prepared to die with my affairs in order, the good and bad messages delivered that need delivering. The good death means dying while my mind is still relatively sharp and aware. It also means dying without having to endure large amounts of suffering and pain. The good death means accepting death as inevitable and not fighting it when the time comes and there is nothing left to be done. What economists sometimes call diminishing marginal returns. That is, however, just one, what I've been describing, just one among many possibilities about what a good death or what a good enough death might look like. And ultimately, of course, your relationship with mortality is your own. Historically speaking, humanity's relationship to mortality has changed drastically over time. For much of human history, the life of our ancestors was one of continual fear and danger, of violent death, and the life of man was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Around 30,000 years ago, life expectancy was around 30. It wasn't until the development of agriculture around 10,000 years ago that things started to change. Soon people recognized that, wait, we get sick less often if we separate our drinking water from our sewage. And in relatively short time, the human race experienced a 20 to 30 year gain in life expectancy. When the first European settlers arrived in North America, to be frank, all they did was die. If it wasn't starvation, the freezing cold, battles with the native people, it was influenza, diphtheria, dysentery, or smallpox that did them in. At the end of the first 3 years of the Jamestown settlement in Virginia, 440 of the original 500 settlers were dead. If you were the mother of five children, you were lucky to have two of them live past the age of 10. Today, plagues, basic infections, childhood diseases have, for the most part, been eradicated. We've added an additional 30 years to the human lifespan just in the past 100 years alone. In 1900, Americans could realistically expect to live to the age of 47. And by the 1930s, 59. By 2000, that age expectancy had reached nearly 80. Infant mortality rates have dropped from 56 deaths per 1,000 births in 1935 to only 7 per 1,000 in the year 2000. One of the most significant results of these changes is that today, most of us in this country, we see and are around death much less frequently than has ever before been the case in human history. A few generations ago, dying at home, hosting a wake with a loved one's body that you had cleaned and put up yourself and had, you know, on your dining room table potentially, that was actually quite common, in burying your dead yourself at home. As recently as 1945, most deaths occurred in the home. By the 1980s, just 17% did. And in recent decades, we've seen increasingly strong pushback against this trend of everyone dying in hospitals that started around the middle of the 20th century. People begin saying, that's not what I want. That's not what they saw their loved ones going through. Such that by 2010, 45% of Americans died in hospice, more than half of them dying in hospice care at home. Now, it's hard to overemphasize the significance and the speed of these changes around our mortality, death, and dying. We are still wrestling with how to live well and die well with longer lifespans and advanced technology. To use a vivid picture from Gwande's book, Being Mortal, for most of human history, a person's relationship with mortality over the course of their life, it looked like a cliff. You stayed on a plateau relatively distant from death until one day something happened to you and you dropped immediately off the cliff. But for increasing numbers of us, modern medicine has made shuffling off this mortal coil more like an extended, bumpy trip down the mountain. Or potentially worse, a long, slow fade in which we approach death like, if you think back to geometry, like an asymptotic curve. We hover just above the edge of mortality, sometimes for a very long time. In extreme cases such as Terry Schiavo or Karen Ann Quinlan, those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Google it. Lots of news coverage about these cases. In those cases, we can't even agree about what dying means anymore. For the vast majority of human history, death meant the almost simultaneous end of heartbeat, breathing, and brain function. But starting in the 1970s, technological innovation made it possible to keep the heart and lungs going almost indefinitely in many cases. So you could keep what sometimes, instead of being called life support, you're seeing it being called physiological support, because it's not actually supporting life. But this technological changes created difficult dilemmas for some families, because patients in a persistent vegetative state, even when the brain, to be a little graphic, had atrophied such that you only had the brain stem remaining, even at that point, you can still, in many cases, still have people in a persistent vegetative state follow a regular sleep schedule, yawn, open their eyes, blink, and move their arms and legs. They appear alive, but there is zero chance of their body ever regaining sentience. Technology is forcing us to balance life-sustaining measures with quality of life. And regarding how to make these decisions toward the end of life, I'd like to share with you just three brief case studies that show the importance of having these conversations in advance with ourselves and with our loved ones about what does and doesn't make life meaningful for them. These conversations can often be both quite reassuring as well as quite surprising. To give you just one case study from Gawande's Being Mortal, on the eve of a major surgery, a daughter was surprised when her father, who'd been a professor and really loved books and learning, he surprised when her dad said, "Well, if I'm able to eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV, then I'm willing to stay alive. I'm willing to go through a lot of pain," he said, "if I have a shot at that." The next day, the surgeon told her that she had 3 minutes to make a decision about whether to proceed after a spinal bleed had likely already made her father a quadriplegic. She was relieved that he had already made this decision himself. She asked, "If my father survives, will he be able to eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV?" They said, "Yes." She said, "We'll keep operating." She later realized if she had not had that conversation with her father, she would have let him die that day. And in retrospect, he had significant quality of life for 2 more years. When Gawande faced a similar situation with his own father, his dad was clear that he was more afraid of becoming a quadriplegic than of dying. So at a similarly crucial point, he asked the surgeon, which poses a greater risk for his father becoming a quadriplegic in the next couple months, stopping or proceeding with the surgery? The surgeon said, stopping would actually have the greater risk of paralysis over the next few months. So again, it also actually turned out to be the right choice. More importantly, either way it had it turned out, it was his father's own choice for himself. The third case is of a young athlete, a scholar, and an executive diagnosed with a terminal illness. Now, his doctors were surprised that despite the high quality of life that he had experienced prior to his diagnosis, this patient was clear that actually his final months, which had been characterized by relentless physical deterioration and considerable suffering, had actually turned out to be among the best year of his life. And he would not have wanted to prematurely end his life because his physical decline, even though it had been painful and limiting in some ways, had given him the opportunity to repair other aspects of his life. Quality of life can look like many different things to many different people. The important piece is to create that time and space to allow people to say what they want and what actually does give them quality of life. If you haven't had these sort of end-of-life conversations with your loved ones and you're not sure how to start that conversation, I highly recommend Googling The Conversation Project. You can just Google that, but it's theconversationproject.org. Their poignant and provocative motto is, "It is always too soon before it's too late." So just have the conversation. And to be really honest, the upcoming Thanksgiving and winter holidays, those are prime opportunities. When you talk to people about when should we have these conversations, that's when people have time off and they're all together. Relatedly, if you or your loved ones don't have a will, a living will, and a power of attorney, do that today. Do that next week. Don't put it off. And that's something you need to do again every time you have a major life change. You buy a house, you have a kid, you get divorced, you have a major illness. You need to look again at your will, your living will, and your power of attorney. One good starting point for that process, Google 5 wishes. I'll also put the link to these in the sermon manuscript that we put on our website. Now, there's a lot more to say about discerning and supporting end-of-life choices, including the need for death with dignity legislation, but I wanted to be sure to at least touch briefly on the shifts that are happening around what do we do with our bodies on the other side of our mortality. As early as around 100,000 years ago, we have archaeological evidence of Homo sapiens burying their dead, what we would call, with purpose. The bodies are buried in ritualized positions and with ritualized elements included. Now, we can't understand what those ancient people thought about death or the afterlife or even the corpse, but these clues do tell us that they did think about it. The custom used to be natural burial at home, but in the 19th century, a lot of this started springing up around the Civil War. Embalming practices became increasingly common, and then what we saw over the decades were these skyrocketing costs associated with funerals. A turning point came in 1963 for two reasons. One, Jessica Milford published a best-selling expose of the funeral industry titled The American Way of Death. Who remembers or read that book? Okay, quite a few of you. That same year, Pope Paul VI overturned the Roman Catholic Church's ban on cremation. That would all be really interesting. We'll talk about that in February for Darwin Day. Rates of cremation have risen steadily in the years since 1963 with that lifting of the cremation ban and the publication of Mitford's book. In 2014, 44% of Americans chose cremation. It's estimated that by 2020, this will become the majority option. I should also note that instead of actually going back to read The American Way of Death, it's kind of interesting historically, but the really great 21st century parallel I'd recommend is an excellent memoir called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory by Caitlin Doughty. She's a young hipster funeral director that's really part of leading edge of the current alternative funeral industry. I really recommend her books, Being Mortal and Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Currently, my will calls for me to be cremated, but I'm less convinced than I once was that it's the cleanest or simplest choice. On one hand, it is an improvement environmentally from filling the earth with concrete vaults and bodies full of toxic chemicals. The average 10-acre cemetery contains enough coffin wood to build 40 homes and has enough toxic formalin to fill a backyard swimming pool. That's every 10 acres of cemetery. On the other hand, significant energy is required and hazardous emissions are released in the process of heating an oven to 1,800 degrees for 4 hours to turn a body into ashes. And it denies part of what Nancy was talking about with Edward Abbey of, you know, putting your, recycling yourself, as it were. I'm increasingly interested in the green burial movement, in which bodies without any chemical preparation are buried with a simple cloth shroud. In some of these cemeteries, sometimes people also do it on their land and in their own backyard, so to speak. But in some of these cemeteries, after a certain number of years, depending on local soil and weather conditions, another person can be buried in that same spot, which makes sense with, you know, 7 billion plus people on this planet, and where are we going to put them? The number of Green Burial Council approved cemeteries, you can Google Green Burial Council if you want to learn more. In North America, they've grown from 1 in 2006 to 300 today. There are 3 in DC Metro. For now, as we continue to wrestle with the meaning of mortality and with our response to being alive and having to die, I'll close with these words from the poet Mary Oliver. She writes, "To live in this world, you must be able to do 3 things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing that your own life depends on it. And when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go." Let me share just 1 or 2 quick things from my family. So I shared some just general thoughts about mortality, and it has been my honor as being a minister for, you know, a decade and a half plus now to accompany families on, you know, in these end of life journeys. It's incredibly moving and meaningful, but those aren't my stories to tell. So let me tell you just a quick story from a few examples of the things I carry with me from witnessing these in my own family. When I was 15, as many of you know, my father died of esophageal cancer, and it was evident by around, so I was a freshman in high school, evident around Christmas Eve was the last time he went to work, and he died in March. And just really grateful that he was able to be on hospice, because he was able to extend his life through some hospitalizations and treatments, but he hated the hospital, hated being woken up. So being able to spend his final months at home in a hospital bed, that was a tremendous gift. He said that all the time. He would ask my mother, he's like when he'd have a bad day occasionally, he said, "Is she going to take me to the hospital? and you, and just being able to tell him, no, you're going to be able to die at home, was a tremendous comfort to him. My grandmother died, my maternal grandmother died this past year, and I never expected we'd cremate her. So that was an interesting to sort of see. That to me was a sign of the shift of, and she also was able to, she lived in her own home about a mile away from my mother till she was 95 when she died. She died very quickly. And I always wanted her to go to an assisted living facility, but it's not what she wanted, and she never quite had to. And that was, I'm grateful for that. My paternal grandmother had Alzheimer's, and that was probably the hardest death that I've personally sort of intimately lived through. And what I carry with me is my grandfather and my grandmother had a beautiful marriage, but I just remember him saying on quite a few occasions, he just used to say, she's just not good to herself or anyone else anymore. And it was just heartbreaking for him and to sort of live with that. Her name was Grace, and what I'm grateful for is that unlike some people get really angry with some of these dementia diseases, and she never did. She was always beautiful, sweet, and pleasant to the very end. And with my grandfather, it's the last story I'll tell. My paternal grandfather also lived to be, she was in her late 80s, my grandmother Grace. My grandfather Leonard lived to be 96 and was a farmer and lived at home. The last few months he was in the hospital, in the nursing home. And what finally, he started to have kidney failure, and he could have actually lived longer, but he said the medication made his food all taste terrible. And for him, he was just like, I don't want to live like that. And so he said, I'm just going to not take the medication and I'm going to enjoy eating. And that was, you know, so these are hard decisions. Lots of stories. I'd be glad to talk with any of you who are discerning around these decisions for yourself and your loved ones. But all I can say is around end of life or every decision we make in this life, try to continue your journey with love, to care for one another and to do whatever we choose, to care for the earth in doing it. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you out into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.